The headlines. Russia says it has taken control of a southern Ukrainian city amid fierce clashes in the northeastern city of Kharkiv on the seventh day of the conflict. The European Union expands its sanctions against Russian banks as Moscow takes more measures to confront the bans. Also in the headlines, Iran says its bitter experience with the U.S. non-compliance and Europe's inaction has prompted Tehran to push for a reliable and sustainable agreement in the Vienna talks.
Welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
It is the seventh day of Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Moscow now claims to have taken over Kherson, a southern Ukrainian port city on the Black Sea.
Russian armed forces have taken the city of Kherson under total control. Civilian infrastructure, critical infrastructure, and public transport work as usual. There is no shortage of groceries or staple goods.
Ukraine officials deny Russia's claim and say the fighting continues for Kherson. The Ukrainian army has also reported street battles in the country's second biggest city of Kharkiv, where Russian paratroopers have landed. Authorities say that four people were killed in shelling there this morning. The capital, Kiev, is also under attacks. On Tuesday, Ukraine reported the death of five people in an airstrike on a television tower in Kiev. Officials put the overall civilian deaths in Ukraine at over 2,000 so far. In fresh remarks, the Ukrainian president says almost 6,000 Russians have lost their lives, a claim that has not been verified.
Just think about this figure. Almost 6,000 Russians died. Russian servicemen within 6 days of war, a figure without enemies' losses during the past night. 6,000. To receive what? To receive Ukraine? It is impossible. It will not happen with rockets. It will not happen with bombs, tanks, any strikes.
Russia acknowledges that it has sustained losses, but so far has given no figures. The Russian Defense Ministry says that its forces have destroyed over 1,500 Ukrainian military targets, including 60 planes. Ukraine denies suffering military losses on such a scale. Russia's Defense Minister has pledged to push ahead with the operation until all the objectives are achieved. In the meantime, a second round of talks between Russia and Ukraine is scheduled on Wednesday. Previous talks failed to produce any breakthroughs. Ukraine says Russia must stop bombing cities before meaningful talks on a ceasefire could start. Russia says it sees no desire on the part of Ukraine to try to find a balanced solution. Moscow is hit with more sanctions as the conflict between Russia and Ukraine continues unabated. U.S. media reported that Washington is preparing further curbs on Russian oligarchs, as well as their companies and family members. Meanwhile, the European Union has excluded seven Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned two major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. In recent days, Moscow has retaliated with sanctions and restrictions of its own. Moreover, experts say Russia will try to ease the pain of sanctions by taking extra measures. Those moves could include relying on energy sales, gold reserves, cryptocurrency, and Russia's relationship with China. The U.S. President Joe Biden has delivered his first State of the Union address to Congress. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine was the primary theme of his speech, during which he pledged that the West will be all united in the face of the Russian attack on Ukraine.
He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready. We are united, and that's what we did. We stayed united.
Biden had some tough words for President Vladimir Putin, accusing him of launching a premeditated and unprovoked war on Ukraine. He called Putin a dictator and said that he will pay a continuing high price over the long run. Biden said Washington, with the help of his allies, is inflicting economic pain on Russia. And he even announced a ban on Russian flights.
We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy.
Biden also said, and these are his own words, that Washington is choking off Russia's access to technology that will sap its economic strength and weaken its military for years to come. The U.S. president blamed his Russian counterpart for the anti-Moscow sanctions and claimed that Putin has never been so isolated. Biden said the conflict with Ukraine will leave Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. The Russia-Ukraine conflict is forcing tens of thousands of people to cross Ukraine borders. According to UN estimates, roughly 830,000 Ukrainians have already fled to neighboring countries. Nearly 160,000 people are said to have crossed the border since Tuesday. The UN Refugee Agency warns that a surge in refugees could possibly reach 1 million within hours. Currently, refugees have been accepted into countries that have followed a hard stance on non-European migrants such as Poland, Hungary, and Austria, among others. Meanwhile, the European Union has announced plans to give concessions to Ukrainian refugees. Some member states are even planning to grant Ukrainians protection, residency, and access to employment.
The first refugees fleeing from conflict-stricken Ukraine have arrived in northern Italy as Europe braces, the media are saying, for a major humanitarian crisis. So far, arriving refugees, who mostly comprise women, children and the elderly, have been registered in four Italian regions, namely Trentino, Veneto, Emilia-Romagna and Friuli-Venezia Giulia. In addition, scores of African-born expats have joined hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to escape Ukraine and cross into Poland and other neighboring countries. Reports have emerged suggesting that many black refugees have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
Africans are being stopped from leaving Ukraine because of the color of their skin. It is shocking. It brings us back to the dark age of racism and intolerance against black people. I'm disgusted. Also because the media here in Italy do not cover these stories as they should.
Nigeria and South Africa have denounced such discrimination, calling on border officials in Ukraine and its neighbors to treat their nationals equally. About 30,000 Africans, mostly from Nigeria, Morocco and Egypt, reside in Ukraine. They make up more than 20% of Ukraine's international students, attracted by the country's good technical and medical schools, combined with relatively low fees.
It's a basic principle in international refugee law, as well as in all human rights law, the principle of non-discrimination, a basic principle which has to be observed by all states, also here, certainly by Poland, Ukraine and the other countries around Ukraine.
The Italian government has recently agreed to redistribute Ukrainian refugees across the European Union. Italy will likely receive 13% of the total allocation. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Mario Draghi said, while reporting to the Senate on the Ukraine crisis, that, quote, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a decisive turning point in European history. Max Civili, Rome.
Data shows the Eurozone inflation soared to a new record high last month, mainly due to surging energy prices on the continent. The EU's official statistics agency, Eurostat, announced 5.8% inflation in the euro area in February, up 0.7% from the previous month. The rise comes as oil and gas prices skyrocketed due to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. European natural gas prices have hit their historic peak, while oil surged to seven-year highs amid fears of supply disruptions. Brent crude topped $113 a barrel for the first time since 2014, and U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude followed suit hours later to hit the level of 2013. On Tuesday, the International Atomic Energy Agency, or the International Energy Agency, which includes the U.S., agreed to release 60 million barrels of crude reserves to try and curb soaring prices. But the disruption from Russia, one of the world's top oil and gas suppliers, could send prices even higher. Iran says the bitter experience it has had with the U.S. non-compliance and Europe's inaction regarding the 2015 agreement has prompted it to push for a reliable and sustainable deal in the Vienna talks. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Adi Shamkhani, made those comments during a meeting with a number of lawmakers. Shamkhani said in addition to putting forth efforts to remove the sanctions, Iran is also focusing its strategy on neutralizing the effects of those sanctions. The lawmakers present at the session also called for the Iranian negotiating team to keep pushing so that a possible final agreement would compensate the Iranian people for the losses that they have incurred. The German chancellor says an agreement on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal known as the JCPOA cannot be postponed any longer. Olaf Scholz made the comments in a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett in the city of Al-Quds. He added that a decision on reaching a good and reasonable accord must be taken now. Iran has rejected any deadlines set by the West to restore the agreement. It is also reiterated that the JCPOA's revival hinges on political decisions by the U.S. and European signatories to the pact. Tehran wants the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again as it did in 2018. Our Vienna correspondent Tomaleski says Iranian and European negotiators are focusing on the remaining outstanding issues in the talks to revive the JCPOA. She says according to Iran's stance, the removal of sanctions and guarantees for effective implementation of a possible deal should be materialized.
That these negotiations between Iran and the Europeans are still continuing behind me in the Cobourg. So what are they focused on? Of course, the outstanding remaining issues, which are, as far as we've been told, both by Iranians and other sources, the issue of sanctions, the sanctions that Iran wants to be removed, as well as guarantees, the economic, political and legal guarantees that Iran is looking for, and of course the issue of the IAEA probe into Iran's past activities. Iranian officials and sources making it clear that it is vital for this team to have that issue closed because they do not want it to be used, in the words of one political analyst, as a loophole to take the JCPOA hostage when it comes to implementation. They want to have all the necessary assurances and guarantees that if the JCPOA is going to be implemented, it will be implemented effectively. There won't be, again, this danger of the U.S. withdrawing or reimposing sanctions without consequences. Iran doesn't want this issue of time pressure or deadlines to impede, you know, the successful conclusion of the talks in a way that would be acceptable to the Iranian team.
The U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's latest comments about Iranian nuclear scientists is drawing outrage from Iranian officials. Tehran's permanent representative to the U.N. describes the remarks as provocative and terror-inciting. Majid Takht-e-Ravanchi says Graham's comments are an invitation to additional terrorist acts against Iranian scientists. The U.N. ambassador described the remarks as repulsive, abhorrent, and reprehensible. He said that such rhetoric only serves as a green light to the Israeli regime perpetrate more terrorist acts against Iranian nuclear scientists. In an interview in mid-February, Graham said that a lot of Iranian scientists have had a lot of accidents, adding the U.S. would expect even more accidents to come. Several Iranian scientists have been assassinated in Israeli terrorist operations in Iran, the last one being Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who lost his life in a targeted killing near Tehran in November 2020. The European Union is urging the Israeli regime to stop using violence against Palestinians as Tel Aviv's atrocities are taking place on a daily basis. The European bloc, in a Twitter message, has expressed concern about the daily attacks on the occupied West Bank. It says that Israel must stop the use of excessive force and live ammunition against Palestinian civilians. The violence against Palestinians is on the rise in the occupied territories. On Tuesday, regime forces killed three Palestinians in the West Bank. One of the victims was killed near the city of Bethlehem, while two others lost their lives in a raid by Israeli forces on the Jenin refugee camp. The UN Security Council has imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Yemeni officials say such an embargo should be imposed on Saudi Arabia and its allies for their deadly war on Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
Following the recent retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army and its aerial strikes on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the United Nations Security Council imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. This measure was proposed by the UAE in an attempt to curtail the military capabilities of the Yemeni army. In a Twitter post, the member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, criticized the measure, saying it has ignored war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition. He noted that any arms embargo that does not apply to the Western-backed coalition has no value. Saudi Arabia and its allies have launched a deadly war on Yemen since the beginning of 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its retaliatory attacks against Saudi and Emirati territories.
Experts say the Yemeni army depends on local military industries in addition to the spoils of war left by the Saudi-led coalition's forces after escaping the battlefronts. They believe that the UN resolution will make no difference as Yemen is besieged by Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turkey has implemented an international pact on naval passage to the Black Sea. Under the 1936 Montreux Convention, Turkey has the right to close two of its straits to warships. This a week after Ukraine asked Ankara to activate the international pact and prevent the transit of Russian warships from the Mediterranean to the Black Sea. Russian Sagalan reports from Istanbul.
Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits.
Turkey is following a balanced policy between the two countries. The president already clearly stated that Ankara will not take side and stand with neither Russia nor Ukraine. However, enforcing the Montreux Convention is an international procedure, which will not affect Russia negatively, and Ukraine had already asked for it, hence Turkey will not be put in a position to choose sides. However, Turkey already rejects the Russian military action.
Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold the drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alfred W. McCoy, writer. This article is published under the heading, Melting of Ice Sheets is Dramatic, but Melting of Permafrost Means Mass Death. Stay tuned for more. Thank you. When midnight strikes on New Year's Day of 2050, there will be little cause for celebration. But for most of humanity, it will just be another day of adversity bordering on misery, a desperate struggle to find food, water, shelter, and safety. In the previous decades, storm surges will have swept away coastal barriers erected at enormous cost, and rising seas will have flooded the downtowns of major cities that once housed more than 100 million people. Relentless waves will pound shorelines around the world, putting villages, towns, and cities at risk. As several hundred million climate change refugees in Africa, Latin America, and South Asia fill leaky boats or trash over land in a desperate search for food and shelter, affluent nations worldwide will be trying to shut their borders even tighter, pushing crowds back in tear gas and gunfire. Yet those reluctant host countries, including the United States, won't faintly be immune from the pain. Every summer, in fact, ever more powerful hurricanes propelled by climate change will pummel the East and U.S. Gulf Coast of this country, possibly even forcing the federal government to abandon Miami and New Orleans to the rising tides. Meanwhile, wildfires, already growing in size in 2021, will devastate vast stretches of the West, destroying thousands upon thousands of homes every summer and fall in an ever-expanding fire season. This dismal vision of life circa 2050 comes not from some flight of literary fantasy, but from published environmental science. Indeed, we can all see the troubling signs of global warming around us right now, worsening wildfires, ever more severe ocean storms, and increased coastal flooding. While the world is focused on the fiery spectacle of wildfires destroying swathes of Australia, Brazil, California, and Canada, a far more serious threat is developing, only half attended to. In the planet's remote polar regions, not only are the ice caps melting with frightening speed, already raising sea levels worldwide, but the vast Arctic permafrost is fast receding, releasing enormous stores of lethal greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. At that frozen frontier far beyond our ken or consciousness, ecological changes brewing largely invisibly deep beneath the Arctic tundra will accelerate global warming in the ways sure to inflict untold future misery on all of us. More than any of other place or problem, the thawing of Arctic frozen earth, which covers vast parts of the roof of the world, will shape humanity's fate for the rest of the century, destroying cities, devastating nations, and rupturing the current global order. In assessing the likely course of climate change by 2050, one question is paramount. How quickly will we feel its impact? For decades, scientists thought that climate change would arrive at what science writer Eugene Linden called stately pace. In 1975, the U.S. National Academies of Sciences still felt that it would take centuries for the climate to change in a meaningful way. As late as 1990, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, concluded that the Arctic permafrost, which stores both staggering amounts of carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, an even more dangerous greenhouse gas, was not yet melting and that the Antarctic ice sheets remained stable. In 1993, however, scientists began studying ice cores extracted from Greenland's ice cap and found that there had been 25 rapid climate change events in the last glacial period thousands of years ago, showing that the climate could change massively within a decade or two. Driven by a growing scientific consensus about the dangers facing humanity, representatives of 196 states met in 2015 in Paris, where they agreed to commit themselves to a 45% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and achieve net carbon neutrality by 2050 to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This, they argued, would be sufficient to avoid the disastrous impacts sure to come at 2 degrees Celsius degrees or higher. However, the bright hopes of that Paris conference faded quickly. Within 3 years, the scientific community realized that the cascading effects of global warming reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels would be evident not in the distant future of 2100, but perhaps by 2040, impacting most adults alive today. The medium-term effects of climate change will only be amplified by the uneven way the planet is warming, with a far heavier impact in the Arctic. According to a Washington Post analysis, by 2018, the world already had hot spots that had recorded an average rise of 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial norm. As the sun strikes tropical latitudes, huge columns of warm air rise and then are pushed toward the poles by greenhouse gases trapped in the atmosphere until they drop down to Earth at higher latitudes, creating spots with faster rising temperatures in the West Asia region, Western Europe, and above all, the Arctic. In a 2018 IPCC Doomsday Report, its scientists warned that even at just 1.5 degrees Celsius, temperature increases would be unevenly distributed globally and could possibly reach a devastating 4.5 degrees Celsius in the Arctic high altitudes, with profound consequences for the entire planet. Recent scientific research has found that by 2050, the key drivers of major climate change will be feedback loops at both ends of the temperature spectrum. At the hotter end in Africa, Australia, and the Amazon, warmer temperatures will spark ever more devastating forest fires, reducing tree cover and releasing vast amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. This in turn, as is already happening, will fuel yet more fires and so create a monstrous self-reinforcing feedback loop that could decimate the great tropical rainforests of this planet. The even more serious and uncontrollable driver, however, will be in the planet's polar regions. There, an Arctic feedback loop is already gaining a self-sustaining momentum that could soon move beyond humanity's capacity to control it. By mid-century or before, as ice sheets continue to melt disastrously in Greenland and Antarctica, rising oceans will make extreme sea level events like once-in-a-century storm surges and flooding annual occurrences in many areas. If global warming grows beyond the maximum 2 degrees Celsius target set by the Paris Agreement, depending on what happens to Antarctica's ice sheets, ocean levels could increase by a staggering 43 inches as this century ends. In fact, a worst-case scenario by the National Academies of Sciences projects a sea level rise of as much as 20 inches by 2050 and 78 inches in 2100, with a catastrophic loss of 690,000 square miles of land and expanse 4 times the size of California, displacing about 2.5 percent of the world's population and inundating major cities like New York. Adding to such concerns, a recent study in Nature predicted that by 2060, rain rather than snow could dominate parts of the Arctic, further accelerating ice loss and raising sea levels significantly. Moving that doomsday ever closer, recent satellite imagery reveals that the ice shelf holding back Antarctica's massive DeWayes Glacier could shatter within 3 to 5 years, quickly breaking that Florida-sized frozen mass into hundreds of icebergs and eventually resulting in several feet of sea level rise on its own.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are presently focusing on the first sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha, and here in one part of the sermon he speaks about the Quran, the revolutionary aspect of the Qur'an, and how the Qur'an has an awakening nature, a nature that forces a human being, that infuses a state of hope, strength, and movement within a person. And we notice that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his family, was like that, always looking to create the right change in the community foundationally and structurally from the start, so that it grows properly. And this is a very powerful aspect of his. Another thing is that he was someone who was true to the promise that he gave to the people. Just like the Quran is true to its promises, the Prophet ﷺ was also like that. And the reason why I'm talking about the Prophet right now is that since we've just passed the date of Mab'ath, the Eid of Mab'ath, where the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was appointed as a prophet and a messenger, but also because it is related to the Quran.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Oh,
Now, the Holy Prophet ﷺ would promise the people, and his only expectations from the people was that they worship God. He would promise them that he would perform some important issues, but his expectation from the people was just that they should worship one God and dedicate their life, their lives to him. We notice that the Prophet was dealing with the people in such a way that was unlike any other leader in the whole of humanity. You notice how when the war booty would come, and he would be one of those people in line for the division to happen. He wouldn't put anything specific to himself for his personal use. No, he would treat himself just like others. In fact, he was so gentle with the people and so normal with the people that sometimes some of the people would come, and when they would sit with him, they would raise their legs, their feet in front of him. Some would even come to clip their nails in front of him. So you can imagine if someone would go in front of one of those emperors of that time and would, for example, raise his feet in front of him, or for example sit while their feet have been stretched towards the leader, how would the leader react? How would the king or emperor react? Or if someone would come and clip their nails in front of him or in front of that leader. So you can imagine that the Prophet had such levels of softness that people were very comfortable with him. And this is a sign of a strong leader, one who really can create change in the people. And he was not after any material benefits, and in fact, in terms of material benefits, he would always prefer others above him and sacrifice whatever he had for others. And one of his other qualities was the way he kept promises. He had promised that humanity shall be given its true value, should be given its true status. And we see that is exactly what happened, that there was no distinction between the rich, the poor, the black or the white, or there was no discrimination. And he removed that plague from the community.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, the Prophet ﷺ, through the teachings of the Quran, he brought about this state in the society whereby there was no discrimination, there was no injustice. That was because of the way the Prophet ﷺ was applying the teachings of the Quran on the people. And as I mentioned, he kept his promises when it came to humanity, that he would make humans noble, he would teach them the path of nobility. We noticed that they had become so noble and strong that these same Muslims would go travel and send the message of Islam to different parts of the world, even to the kings of Persia, the kings of Rome. And wherever they would go with such honor and strength that they would, feel that all these other leaders are just normal human beings like themselves. They would not be awestruck by their grandeur, their material and apparent grandeur. They were such strong in their beliefs and in the strength that they had as human beings. So this was something that the Holy Prophet did, was to return to the people, to all the human beings, the feeling of honor as a human, that feeling of strength as a human being, that feeling of power. And this was the way he took the society ahead. He had promised to fight oppression, and yes, he did fight oppression. He promised to obliterate polytheism, and he did obliterate polytheism as long as he was alive. He strongly took that flag of fighting falsehood, and he was able to be successful, of course, in the best of methods, with the best of charisma and kindness and love. And his character was such that people would naturally get pulled towards him instead of them turning away from him. Anyways, this is all the fact that the Prophet ﷺ had kept those particular promises that were there to bring about change in the society. And this is something that actually gives us an understanding about the role of the leader in an Islamic ummah, and the role of the Quran as a guide for the Prophet ﷺ and for the people in materializing this particular aim of Islam. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, police officers fear retaliation if they step in to stop misconduct by other police officers. In the wake of George Floyd's death, police departments are trying to change that. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Shayla Dewan. The piece is titled, A New Message for Police. If you see something, say something. On an early Monday morning in a chilly classroom in Baltimore, Maryland, a diverse group of recruits to one of the nation's most troubled police departments gathered for a new kind of training. The screen flashed a photo of a man whose face is now familiar to the world. What happened to George Floyd? The instructor barked. He was lynched, one trainee responded. He was murdered, another trainee said. How many other police officers were there? The instructor asked. Many knew the answer. Three. That was the crux of the matter at hand. Not the senior officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck, Derek Chauvin, but the three others who did not stop him. The question of what other police officers could or should have done was not abstract. More than 1,000 miles away, those same three former police officers, two of them ranked rookies, were standing trial on charges that they failed to prevent the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May of 2020. On Thursday, They were convicted and could face many years in prison. For decades, many police critics have complained that police officers who allow police misconduct to happen do more damage to the community's trust than the police officers who commit it. Yet, they have not been a focus. When Rodney King was tased and beaten by four Los Angeles police officers in 1991, more than a dozen other police officers looked on. None of the onlookers faced charges. The federal trial of Tu Tao, J. Alexander Kung, and Thomas Lane in Minnesota this month was one of the rare attempts to hold police officers to account over the issue. The duty to stop a fellow police officer who is engaging in misconduct has long been embedded in many department policies and upheld by the courts of law. But the defendants in Minnesota argued that during their training, it was little more than a word on a PowerPoint. Police officers across the United States have been told they must intervene if they see a fellow police officer behave in misconduct, but they have not necessarily been taught how to do so. George Floyd's death has begun to change that. More than 215 police departments have signed up for a Georgetown University program that teaches police officers the philosophy and techniques of intervention. Watching the Floyd video, you're thinking the only thing that could have snapped any one of those police officers out of it would have been for another one of them to intervene, said Chief Kelly McCarthy of Mendota Heights, a Minneapolis suburb, whose department has begun to use the training. Dallas, Seattle, Los Angeles, Cleveland, Washington, D.C., and all of New Jersey are also participating. Active bystander training is not new. The airline industry and hospitals have used it to empower co-pilots and nurses to speak up to prevent mistakes. And it has even been used to help stop sexual assault on college campuses. Its use in policing began in New Orleans in 2016, after a number of police officers faced criminal charges, including a rookie who went to prison for helping cover up a fatal beating perpetrated by his training officer. But other police departments have been slow to adopt such programs for many reasons. The paramilitary structure of law enforcement agencies discourages questioning the chain of command, and departments have a long track record of retaliating against whistleblowers. Police officers who break the culture of silence risk being passed over for promotions or even being fired themselves, as Cariel Horn in Buffalo, New York, was after she stopped a white police officer from choking a black subject. To overcome these barriers, trainees are told that program is not about ratting about their comrades, but stopping them from committing misconduct in the first place. They are told to think of police officers in need of intervention as humans who get tired and stressed and make mistakes, and of themselves as helpers who can respond to warning signs of mental illness, addiction, or suicide. Intervention, the premise goes, it's just one more way that police officers take care of one another. We get an opportunity to redefine this whole freaking thing about the thin blue line, redefine what it means to have each other's back, said Jerry Clayton, the sheriff in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's so hypocritical to criticize the community around no snitching, an unwritten rule on the street that police officers say prevents them from solving crimes. And then we turn around and say, I can talk about that thing that happened. Michael Harrison was the chief who started the training in New Orleans in 2015 with the help of Irvin Staub, a psychologist and Holocaust survivor who has studied the dynamics of bystander intervention. Michael Harrison brought the program with him to Baltimore, Maryland, where he's now the commissioner. At both police departments, he has been charged with correcting a pattern of constitutional violations under agreements with the Justice Department known as consent decrees. Historically, loyalty was looked at as, if I confide in you, you keep my secret, Commissioner Harrison said. We started teaching loyalty should be displayed on the front end to prevent potential injury, death, career ruin, or even worse. The bottom line, he said, let me help you not make this mistake in the first place. In the 2 years after New Orleans trained its police officers, the number of canine bites, police shootings, vehicle chases, and use of force complaints dropped. Because of other changes mandated by the consent decree, it is not clear how much of those declines are attributable to intervention training. But close observers like Jonathan Aroney, the Federal Monitor, say it helped change department culture. In Baltimore this month, the trainees acted out scenarios that might call for intervention. In one police officer begins an illegal search of a woman's car. In another, a supervisor pressures a police officer to pretend he did not hear a suspect ask for a lawyer, a request that normally would put an end to an interrogation. Just listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at the virtue of quenching someone's thirst in Islam. We have numerous traditions about the virtue of quenching someone's thirst. If somebody's thirsty, giving them a glass of water, quenching their thirst. One of these traditions has been narrated from the fourth imam of the family of the Prophet, Imam Zayn al-Abidin, alayhi salam. The imam says, whoever quenches a believer of his thirst, Allah will quench him from the pure sealed wine of paradise. The actual words of the hadith are, min ar-rahiq al-makhtum. This is a reference to one of the wines which have been mentioned in the Holy Quran, in one of the surahs of the Holy Quran. There is mention of wine in general as one of the blessings of paradise. But this wine is a very special one because it's been singled out and mentioned in the Holy Quran, specifically separately from those other wines. Of course, by wine here, we're not referring to worldly wine, the intoxicant and alcohol, which leads to the intoxication of a person. This is a spiritual drink which exists in the hereafter and is of a different nature than the wine, the worldly wine that is an intoxicant. Right, so the imam says that if somebody quenches a believer's thirst, Allah will reward him with and allow him to drink of this wine from paradise. In the same vein, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam has also been narrated to have said, if you have committed many sins, then quench people's thirst time after time. Right? So in the first tradition, we saw that the Imam mentioned one of the positive effects of quenching people's thirst. God will reward you with the wine of paradise. Here the Holy Prophet mentions another effect of this good and virtuous deed, and that is that if you've committed a lot of sins and you quench people's thirst, Allah Ta'ala will erase those sins. Right? So like, it's say that you have done a lot of bad deeds and you want to, you want to be forgiven from them, you can quench people's thirst, right? Time after time, meaning continuously do this. How do you do this? Well, one of the ways we can do this is on in the commemoration of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. We can set up stopping posts and give out water to the people who are mourning the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. And this way, this is one of those ways in which we can eradicate our sins. This tradition, second tradition, is interesting because in contrast to the first one, it just mentions, it doesn't mention the believers specifically. It says if you quench people's thirst. It doesn't say if those people,